thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a bi-weekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 2 for March 21st, 2007. The Old and the YouTube. I'm Dan Cohen, this week's host. Well, it's great to be back once again for our second podcast. We made it to podcast number 2. I guess that's a sign of modest success here in the podcast world. And I think one of the things that's been great about it is... You know, Mills and Tom are here with me again. Actually, maybe we should do introductions again. I'm Dan Cohen. And with me are the regulars, Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
And Mills Kelly from edwired.org. Hey, Mills.
Hey, Dan. How are you today?
Pretty good. You just got back from Cambodia.
That's right. Yeah, quite a week in Cambodia.
Wow. We'll have to maybe hear a little bit about that. And whether you encountered any technology other than very basic ones there. As I was saying, I think one of the things we've learned here on the podcast is, and one of the things we like to do at the Center for History and New Media is learn by doing. We do some theorizing, but I think doing and just trying out this podcast has been a good learning experience for us. So hopefully we'll get even more proficient at it. And I think we're learning a little bit about the genre as well. And hopefully... through some more feedback from our listeners, we can buff up this podcast into a nice shine. Where we wanted to start today was to actually look back at last week a little bit. Usually we start with our news roundup, and we had so much news actually about our featured story from last week on Wikipedia. And actually, speaking of lessons from doing, I guess one of the things we learned from last week is we probably shouldn't talk about Windows Vista anytime soon again. Don't you think, Tom and Mills?
I think definitely. We got some fairly serious criticism about our long talk about Vista. I think personally it was necessary to get that over with, and I'm glad we did in the first show, but we promised no more Vista for at least a couple of weeks.
Must have a lot of Mac users out there. But yes, we will, Vista hiatus. No more Vista for a little while on this podcast. The story that took off, it was already taking off when we discussed it a couple of weeks ago, but the Wikipedia story, boy, has there been a lot of news over the last couple of weeks, and actually, I think a lot of it feeds right into our discussion, particularly what I think Mills was saying about learning from Wikipedia. Mills, did you see the op-ed in the Chronicle of Higher Education by Kathy Davidson? I think she made a lot of the same points that you did.
I did. I looked at that, and I think she and I are basically in agreement on this issue, and that how important it is that we teach our students how to use this resource appropriately. I was reminded of it again when I was in Cambodia because I was working at the National Teachers Training College and showing these folks there who were high school teachers in training, showing them how Wikipedia works, and they all were using Wikipedia as a source for information, both in English and in Khmer, but they had no idea that anyone could edit the entries, and were, I have to say, quite surprised to find out that things could be changed so simply. So it just, it reinforced for me yet again why it's so important to teach people how to use this resource that they're using anyway.
I hadn't thought about that, but as radical as Wikipedia is for Americans or American students, it must be even odder, I suppose, in countries that have had autocratic forms of government and information ministries and things like that. To democratically be able to edit a source must seem very bizarre. What did the students make of it?
They it did seem really bizarre to them, both for the reasons that you cited, but also because they're in some ways so new to thinking critically about technology resources at all. I mean, they're still in the adoption stage and the very rapid adoption stage, and so anything that they could find online was great. And they're so starved for information resources generally that to anything they could find was a wonderful resource for them to use. And so then to find out that it was a malleable resource was really a really a shocker. Mm.
And how many entries are in Chimera?
It was only about 215. There's a real problem for Khmer usage on the internet, and that is that they have this really funky character set in their really funky script, which is hard to render on screen. And so that's one problem. The other problem was that they didn't know that that there actually was a Khmer option in Wikipedia, because the choice is, instead of en.wikipedia.org for English, it's KM, which they never thought to look under, because the Cambodian domains are KH. So, for some strange reason, Wikipedia has picked KM as its Cambodian language domain, and so it didn't even occur to them to look under that.
That's fascinating.
So they were using the English language version only.
Huh. And did you have them edit some of the entries?
I did. I had them edit one of the entries on Cambodian history, and they were nervous about it. You know, they felt a little strange changing information on the internet, but at the same time, they got fairly excited about it and could see the possibilities of assigning something like this to their students. There are real issues of connectivity in Cambodia, because an hour online in an internet cafe, I mean, almost nobody has connection at home, but an hour online in an internet cafe works out to about 50 cents, which just doesn't seem like a lot, but the average wage in Cambodia is about $1 a day, so it's a pretty significant connection charge for the average person.
Right. Wow. Sounds like a fascinating trip. And you went out into the countryside as well, and I assume there was not ubiquitous Wi-Fi in your Angkor Wat or anything like that.
No.
They don't have a hotspot on top of Angkor Wat?
Not yet. However, the tourist concession in Angkor Wat's been sold to, it's either a Japanese or a Korean company, I can't remember which now. And so before long, they probably will, given that 2 million tourists a year are now coming to Angkor Wat, and there are five-star resorts on the road to get there. So it's undergoing quite a transformation.
Wow.
You know, it's interesting. I think this Wikipedia story has really come out of the, you know, sort of scholarly blog community and really hit the mainstream press. It's sort of taken off. Just in the past couple of weeks, I think, you know, we at CHNM have been contacted by, several mainstream media outlets and documentary filmmakers and other kinds of people interested in this Wikipedia controversy. And I'm starting to see more and more in the circuits in the New York Times and right. other sort of mainstream outlets. It's really seemed to have, something about the Middlebury story seems to have caught fire in the mainstream press.
I think that's right, and I think the mainstream press also, which by the way I happen to like quite a bit, the angle of the story that they like and the reason they like calling academics like us is they want to play up some kind of tension between those who are credentialed and have PhDs and the riffraff of this democracy of people that are contributing to Wikipedia. And I thought a really another interesting story that played into this over the last week or two since our last podcast was this very prominent contributor to Wikipedia, SJ, who claimed to be a tenured professor of theology, I believe. And some people did some snooping into his life, and of course he was using this credentialing of being a professor to gain reputation within the Wikipedia community, and a lot of people deferred to him. And then it turned out, of course, that he's a 24-year-old non-tenured non-professor. And initially Jimbo Wales, the head of Wikipedia, sort of defended SJ and the idea of online identities and pointed out how much he had done to build Wikipedia, but then he sort of after a bunch of criticism in the press, backed away from that position and didn't like what SJ had done, publicly declared that, and SJ actually ended up resigning from the project. And I think it just raised a lot of interesting issues about, you know, what does it mean to have a PhD? You know, we try not to be snooty about it. On the other hand, we know that there are situations where it kind of, you know, can come in handy just from a reputational point of view, even though we might not know as much as, let's say, a very committed amateur. Tom, you've written about this on your blog, but, you know, there are professors who study the Civil War who don't know, say, as much about a specific Civil War battle as a number of amateurs in our state, Virginia.
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, it raises the issue of authority and how authority differs online from how what authority is in the academic context. You know, this guy SJ, he carried with him all the authority of a tenured professor on Wikipedia, in part because he was calling himself a tenured professor, but mostly because he had contributed so much to the project, which led Jimmy Wales to defend him initially. And I think this is a tension that, you know, we got into this last week, that our students deal with. Our students come to sources and they see, I think they do recognize authority when they see it. It's just that the authority in these different contexts can differ, and I think it's our job just to teach them how it differs and what authority means.
Right. I certainly wouldn't disparage authority. It's something we trade in every day, and I wouldn't want to get in front of a class and just have it be complete anarchy. But it does, I think, raise a lot of interesting questions about, you know, what it means to be credentialed and what role that might play. And I think we mentioned this Citizendium project that Larry Sanger is doing, one of the original Wikipedia founders, who, you know, is putting in the foreground people's credentials and checking on them. It'll be interesting to see if that makes any difference to the way it's constructed and then also the way it's used as well. There was some lighter news, of course, about Wikipedia. Sinbad was declared dead over the weekend.
He was dead for a whole week, wasn't he?
Was it a whole week? I guess his daughter called him and said, just check down Wikipedia. It says you're dead. And he said on the phone to her that wasn't actually the case. And how was
I suppose it's not entirely false. I mean, his career has been dead since the early 90s,
right.
I think.
That's right. Maybe it was some kind of metaphorical entry. It does remind me of the very hilarious Onion headline from last year where Onion had in boldface on the front page, Onion, of course, being the satirical newspaper that comes out of Wisconsin. And they had across the front page, Wikipedia celebrates 750 years of American independence. That was their July 4th headline. And, you know, as historians, it gives you a good chuckle here and there. But, you know, I think those are stories, again, that mainstream press loves to pick up on. And, of course, Wikipedia is littered with errors. But I think what we were discussing last week is the process of it. And I think, Mills, that's what you pointed out and what Kathy Davidson pointed out in the Chronicle.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It's and, you know, I wish we could say that the books in our library written by reputable scholars with PhDs weren't also littered with errors. But as we know, people make mistakes now. But I think I have to point out that the real issue here in many ways in the public discussion is about this tension between those with authority and those who don't have it kind of credential yet.
Right. Well, it certainly feeds into another story that we saw from the last week. South by Southwest was over the weekend, and I think it ended on Monday. And several of the people from the Center for History and New Media actually went, and we were alerted to what looks like one of these bear-baiting panels called Out of Control, Does Education Matter Anymore? Boy, I wish they had a podcast of this panel at South by Southwest, but the description says, do social networking tools eliminate the role of faculty and other authoritative sources? Are courses dead? Have they been replaced by referential webs and empowering wikis? Or do tools threaten the chaotic yellow learning environment where the most connected claim is given the most credence? Wow. That featured some people from UT, Adobe, and Monterey Institute for Technology and Education. Has anyone heard of, did anyone report back about this?
Well, from the center, one of the people who went was Jeremy Boggs over at CleoWeb.org. And, you know, Jeremy thought it was an interesting discussion, but it was more smoke than fire. I think there was a lot of talk, I understand, about the industrial model of education represented by the university versus the new Web 2.0 model of education represented by social networking sites and Wikipedia and social recommendation systems like Delicious. And the idea was that instead of having, you know, a set curriculum, a college major with required courses, wouldn't it be better to have students recommend to each other courses, books, materials, learning modules, and kind of fashion their own curricula out of those pieces. And it does. It raises this issue of authority. And one of the comments Jeremy Boggs had was, if students are allowed just purely to choose their own courses, if they're allowed totally to go in their own directions and just choose courses and choose learning tracks based on the recommendations of their peers, you know, they'd never learn anything about history. No one would ever choose a history course. Most students in our university and elsewhere are required to take certain humanities courses, and some of them, few of them, but some of them, their interest is sparked enough to continue to onto a major and possibly a graduate degree. The question with education is whether you can have a completely unmediated curriculum, and it's unclear whether that's possible.
And, you know, this is actually an issue that I wrote about in my blog last year in a couple of posts. I think I called it the end of the course, ? And in which I asked the same kind of question, which that these panelists were posing. And, I think they raise a really interesting point, which is about the tension between our desire to control what our students learn and our students' right or need to control their own choice of learning. And as long as we've decided that we have this model of the 3-credit course and you need 120 credits to graduate with a bachelor's degree, and I'm still not sure who decided it had to be 120 credits, but that's a pretty standard model. You know, as long as we have that kind of model, then students are really boxed into that what constitutes a 3-credit course, and faculty members are boxed into what could be a 3-credit course worth of material. My own take on this is that I think that we're going to end up in a place of compromise between these two poles, one where the faculty are entirely in charge of what students can and can't learn, and one where the students are totally in charge, where I think we'll have sort of a mixed curriculum of a set series of courses that you have to have if you plan on going into a career in X. You know, if you're going to be a civil engineer, you have to know certain things about structural tolerances and that sort of thing. If you're going to be a nurse, you have to know that human beings have two kidneys and one liver and not the reverse. So because in these fields there are licensing exams, and we know what students have to know in order to pass those licensing exams. If you're going to be a poet or a historian, there is no licensing exam, and so it matters a lot less what the student has to know or doesn't have to know. I mean, there's no harm done in a way if a student chooses to focus her work almost entirely on American history or almost entirely on African history, because, you know, that's a choice, and nobody's going to die as a result of that choice. So I think ultimately where we're going to end up is something where there's some kind of, you know, maybe 60 to 70 credits worth of fairly stipulated or expected work done by students, and then a lot of free-form education after that. And that, I kind of think that's where we're going to end up in 15 years or so.
Wow. I think some of these questions are kind of kind of false questions, in that a lot of these things were decided by the American educational system, you know, centuries ago, or certainly decades ago. If you look at the standard college curriculum for an American college student, there's a lot of choice in it. I mean, compared to European systems, where you're on a set. If you're a history major, you're on a set course. You read a set of books. You don't have much choice in what those are. You take standard exams. Everybody takes the same exam, no matter what courses or lectures they've attended. Whereas in the American system, for an undergraduate, you know, maybe half of your credits are required, but the rest are, you know, sort of liberally dispersed throughout the disciplines, and there actually is a lot of choice in the American system. So I think some of this is, as I said, sort of more smoke than flame.
Well, I think choice of materials and courses is, in fact, part of our featured story that's coming up. So why don't we move to that right now? Well, one of the resources that is making its way into the classroom, I suppose whether faculty like it or not, is YouTube. And I think there's been a lot of news recently that we've been discussing about YouTube. Obviously, the biggest news, I suppose, in the newspapers is Viacom suing YouTube for $1 billion. But in a sort of lesser story, but I think one that we found very interesting, is BBC's big deal with YouTube to provide a lot of content. And I think BBC has really been in the forefront of doing a lot of these online deals. And what's really interesting is just they have this incredible back catalog, which as historians and humanists, we find really interesting. I mean, there's so many clips from the 50s and 60s and 70s that from BBC's back catalog that actually they're already making available in other forms, streaming formats. But evidently, they are going to put some material on YouTube, although I believe initially it's going to be more of a promotional, more promotional content. And Mills, you've spoken a little bit about this. In fact, you've used YouTube quite a bit in your classes. And I thought for our featured story, the three of us wanted to discuss a little bit about, you know, how you use video on the internet for teaching and what something like YouTube, what kind of impact does YouTube have in a teaching environment? So Mills, how did you find YouTube and why did you start using it and what are you doing now with it?
Well, it's very interesting how I ended up using it in my class because about a year ago, we got a grant here at the center to start creating a website on the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe in 1989. And this was right around the same time that YouTube was becoming really hot and trendy. And so I thought, well, I wonder what they have in YouTube from 1989. And so I typed 1989 into the search box. And the first thing I learned is that there was a band called 1989 and they had a lot of music videos.
Heavy metal, or new wave?
You know, I have to say, I skimmed over it, so I can't tell you what their style is because okay. I was looking for other things. I should probably go back and find out. But right away, then I started seeing video clips from the Berlin Wall being torn down and a variety of other things. But what really got me excited as a historian was a particular historical video, which I had taught about. The events, but many times in my classes, but I'd never actually seen it live on video. And this is Nicolae Ceaușescu's last speech in front of the Romanian people in December of 1989 when everything's coming apart for the communists in Eastern Europe and Ceaușescu returns from a foreign trip. If you're a dictator, you should never go out of the country right when things are coming apart, but he made this mistake and then came back and he gives this speech where he assembles the people of Bucharest in the main square and they know how to do this because they've been doing it for 30 years. They know where they're supposed to stand and they know when they're supposed to applaud and when to wave their flags and their banners, and it's very ritualized. And he's up on a balcony above the crowd and he starts speaking and he gets just about a minute and a half into the speech and instead of the crowd cheering, you hear the catcalls coming from below, and you see him falter and look out at the crowd, and he's not sure what to do because in his whole career as the head of the Communist Party in Romania, this has never happened to him before. And you see this indecision on his face, and then you see the Securitate agent, who looks like he's right out of Central Casting, come up behind Ceaușescu and whisper something in his ear and then leave through the doors behind the the communist leader. And then all of a sudden the camera moves away, and then you hear chaos from below, and you hear Ceausescu shouting at the people to listen up, and it's right there. That's the moment when the Romanian regime starts to collapse. Well, I've read about this and I've taught about it, and all of a sudden there it was on my computer screen, and I was watching it. It was a clip from Romanian state television. So this was, for me, it was a really exciting moment to actually see this footage. Based on that, then I started scrolling around in YouTube and found all kinds of historical video that we can use in our classes. Just to give you an idea, I did a quick count yesterday on Tiananmen Square, also from 1989. There are 321 individual videos. Many of these are duplicates of the same thing, but still, there are more than several hundred. On the collapse of the Berlin Wall, 371. Malcolm X speaking, 177. Martin Luther King speaking, 1,060. So, there's an incredible wealth of historical resources in the YouTube database. And interestingly, I checked Metacafe, the big competitor for YouTube now, and there's nothing. Using these same searches, I found nothing.
And Mills, how much of this stuff is copyright? I mean, it's hard to tell sometimes on YouTube, but sometimes it's easy. I mean, how much, like, what's the proportion of the 1989 stuff that is that's probably should be restricted?
I'd say a fairly small amount, because the 1989 stuff, a lot of it is either from East European state television broadcasts, and so since it's state television, then it's a public document, or it's amateur video. And especially a lot of the Berlin Wall stuff is people's video shot with their old VHS cameras and then converted to digital video and put into YouTube. The Malcolm X, Martin Luther King stuff that I cited is, a lot of that is probably copyrighted in the sense that it comes from news broadcasts from the major networks, that kind of thing.
So you know, and like, there's always been a problem with Martin Luther King video, especially the Eye of a Dream speech. So it seems like there's probably some problems with other.
Yeah, probably in a gray area, just because this estate owns a lot of these speeches, Martin Luther King's estate. But
right.
It does raise the question of how students today are very visual, and they're used to video in a way that I suppose we aren't, and I think it does have this visceral impact. Unfortunately, I teach the 19th century mostly, and so there's not a lot of video from the 19th century up on YouTube that I can find. But I think people tend to think of YouTube as just, pranks and cats falling off of TVs and things like that, but there is this just hidden treasure trove of historical material that I had no idea, Mills, before you said that there was that much up there.
Yeah, and there are some problems with finding it, because YouTube catalogs things according to the date that they were uploaded, not according to the date they were created. And so it's often very difficult to know when a particular video clip was created unless the person who uploads it includes that kind of meta information. The other thing I would say
is... people tag them with
some,
that information?
Yeah. Only a few. It's pretty rare for that to happen. But the other thing that I think is very useful as a teaching tool is that when you show your students these, when I show them in class, I'll show them a clip from something, and then I'll point out that I'm taking this from YouTube, and underneath the video there is a discussion from the general public about this video. And so this is a way of thinking about how people in the general public respond to historical artifacts. And so it's not just here's the video, but also here's how the public, or some tiny percentage of the public, perceives that artifact. So that's also, I think, a useful teaching tool. The other thing I was going to say is that I had a really interesting experience showing a clip from the Nuremberg Tribunal back last semester, and it was from a newsreel done by the American government, and it's kind of classic newsreel footage of something like Nuremberg, with the voiceover sounding like the voice of God, and the Nazi war criminals brought to justice before the world, and all that sort of thing. And there's this moment in the clip that I showed where the the accused Nazis march from the entrance into the dock, and there is this kind of lame 1940s filler music that's used to during that procession into the dock by the Nazis, and the students in my class started giggling, and it was the music that was making them giggle. So I stopped the video and said, well, let's talk about that for a minute. Why do you think that's funny? And one of them said, well, that's just ridiculous music to put in something so serious. You should change that. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, you should strip out that sound and put in something more appropriate, like, you know, Mozart's Requiem. And then one of the other students piped up and said, or the Jaws music. And so, you know, we had kind of a laugh about what this would be like. And I said, but then it wouldn't be the historical artifact anymore. And the student who raised his hand originally said, yes, but it would be better. And I said, yes, but it wouldn't be the same. And he said, I know, it would be better. And so we had this, I think, very entertaining discussion about what does it mean to change a historical artifact? And I couldn't get them off the point that it would be better. It was like we were talking about two different things. There was a real disconnect there.
Huh. I mean, this is a case where, from our discussion from last week about Wikipedia, I mean, you know, you've been advocating the students get in there and sort of correct things. And, you know, that's what they're used to, is this you know, culture of the mashup and mixing, remixing, and so that's, I suppose, you know, one of their initial reactions is, let's make this better, let's mix it up with something else, and in this case, that's something that clearly degrades the actual content. I mean, it also makes me wonder, maybe they're not, maybe they're visually literate, but maybe using visual resources that don't have the kind of finish or polish that MTV has, that it, in a sense, will turn them off more than, you know, than a document, than a text, because it doesn't seem valid to them. Is that a possibility?
I think it depends on, I think it's possible. I think it also depends on the class. Now, I was showing this Nuremberg clip in a general education Western Civ course, and so none of these students were planning to be history majors. I think I might have had a very different discussion with a room full of history majors. So I think so.
I think it's interesting that, you know, all of us have been at various points surprised to find so much historical material on YouTube, because it seems, you know, from my surfing of the amateur history web, you know, amateurs have been using YouTube really since its inception as a source for historical material, and they've been participating in that, you know, visual remix culture by creating historical documents, by producing historical pieces on their blogs, by embedding feeds from YouTube, doing things like presenting, you know, their top 10 favorite moments in TV news with clips of, you know, Huntley and Brinkley and Walter Cronkite and various other famous moments in TV news, or they've been producing the top 500 music videos of all time, doing those kinds of things. Almost, you know, really, really doing some historical research, going out, finding primary sources, what for them are primary sources on YouTube, providing commentary, contextualization, doing comparisons and contrasts, really doing the kinds of things that professional historians do, but doing it with these amateur resources, things that were uploaded by amateurs, tend to be very, you know, kind of pop culture resources, the things they find on YouTube, but doing some fairly interesting work, and I think it's just kind of interesting that we in the professional context have been sort of slow to take up YouTube as a resource for teaching and learning and doing history, when the amateur community really latched onto it very, very quickly.
Well, I wonder if we have some legacy from our own education. I mean, I remember in high school, the social studies hour that we had a film was, you know, time to take a small nap or do something else. I mean, I never remember it being exciting or visually interesting. Probably the most interesting films were in physics classes, where they had those fantastic, you know, 1950s and 60s films that were very creative to, you know, in ways to teach physics, but the history films were utterly boring. And I think some of this stuff is much more exciting and has the potential to bring video back into the classroom in, you know, K-12 and also college in ways that, you know, we didn't have before. I also think that the length is important. You know, the ability to show a number of smaller clips rather than making a class watch an hour and a half documentary where they're inevitably going to sort of, you know, phase out at some point. I think that's very interesting. I mean, you can almost use a YouTube video clip, it sounds to me, and I actually haven't done it yet, but it sounds like you can use it in the same way you'd use a short reading or some kind of smaller assignment as part of a syllabus.
Well, I think the big difference is that, you know, YouTube video versus a film strip that we would have seen in high school or a videotape that we would have seen in high school. I mean, YouTube is really a kind of lean forward video experience, whereas the film strip or the movie that we would have seen was a kind of lean back experience. It's an active video experience in the way that Mills was talking about. You know, students know that they can rip out the video from the Flash player on YouTube and change the music. They know that they can take the embed code and dump it onto their blog and mash it up with different videos to create a kind of historical document. You know, it's active versus passive video, and I think that's the real big difference.
And I think it's also worth remembering that the mashup culture that Dan was talking about before is not really all that new. We like to talk about it as though it's new, but you know, Matthew Brady mashed up all those photographs of the Civil War, and you know, he moved the bodies all around and moved the rifles and that to get just the shot that he wanted. So you know, those are, and the National Archives has done a pretty good piece on their website, or the Library of Congress has done a pretty good piece on their website about this, that, you know, those aren't accurate photographs in the sense that we like to claim material is accurate. They're mashups.
Well, I suppose one of the reasons your students wanted to put the Jaws theme on that video is it's ominous to them. This is the music that they associate with something bad about to happen, like a hanging, for instance. And so they can't understand why there's sort of light, you know, coffee or tea time music twittering across this, you know, fairly serious newsreel. And so I think they're questing for some kind of, you know, greater authenticity to it in the same way that Brady was.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and I think Mills is right too, that this is part of a longer tradition of scrapbooking and those kinds of activities, historical activities. And something like YouTube just makes it possible to do with digital video, and makes it in some ways just a richer and more interesting experience.
Well, I have a feeling we're going to be talking about YouTube quite a bit on this podcast. We'll leave it there for now, and I'm sure revisit many of these issues in the weeks to come. Well, it's time once again for our links of the week. The way we like to end the podcast each week is by throwing out some links, some sites, some resources online that we found that we hope our audience will find interesting as well. Mills, what do you have this week?
This week I want to talk about the Document Center of Cambodia. This comes out of my experience this week traveling there. The Documentation Center of Cambodia, which is dccam.org, is a joint project between the Yale University and the group of Cambodian scholars. And it's an online archive from the Khmer Rouge period, the Killing Fields period in Cambodian history. And not only is it thousands of primary sources, but increasingly they're geolocating all those sources. The maps are not available yet, but they're supposed to be sometime later this year. And so at that point, it's going to be a really fabulous GIS application as well. It's really a great online archive.
Wow. Sounds very powerful too, especially as they start plotting these things and just, again, speaking of visceral reactions, just seeing, you know, all of those people and data about it. Sounds very powerful.
Yes.
Tom, what do you have this week?
I've actually got another podcast I'd like to recommend to people. It's called 12 Byzantine Rulers, and you can find it has a horrible URL at www.anders.com/lectures/LarsBronworth/12BYZ.
By the way, we're going to link to this from digitalcampus.tv, so we'll if you couldn't memorize that in one pass, we'll
you can also it. Probably just go to iTunes and search for Byzantine, and it'll probably be the only thing.
There are a lot of Byzantine ruler podcasts out there.
Yeah, I don't know, but you know, in fact, this one is actually pretty popular. You know, it's really popular. We can only hope to be so popular. It's done by a guy named Lars Brownworth, and he is a high school teacher on Long Island. And he's received more than 140,000 downloads of this podcast. I was turned on to it by one of my blog readers, Tim Brixton. But it basically goes through, I think there's like 20 episodes, but it goes through 12, just as it says, 12 Byzantine rulers from beginning with Diocletian and going through Justinian to the Basils and on to the end of the Byzantine Empire. And it's kind of an old-fashioned kind of history, a kind of great man military history type podcast. But it's incredibly well done. It's really well written, well scripted, and Mr. Brownworth really does a great job of narrating it. And you know, I had a long drive home from New York a couple weeks ago, and I listened to almost the entire series in one sitting. It was that interesting. So a piece of non-scholarly history that's really worth checking out.
Sounds great. Well, for this week, I have a digital tool. Which comes out of a project that we're working very closely with on the Zotero project, and that's the Simile project at MIT. And in particular, I want to promote their timeline tool, which I think is just a fantastic tool that's easy to use. It creates online timelines that you can scroll around and add information to. I think it could be used in a number of different ways for visualization of information, for syllabi, for students who want to collaboratively put together a timeline of an era that they're studying. And it's available at simile.mit.edu/timeline. Terrific resource, and we're hoping to actually integrate it with some of the tools that we're working on. So I think this is something to keep track of. Well, we all wanted to thank you once again for joining us. And again, you can find us online on our blogs. Tom is at foundhistory.org. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Dan.
And Mills can be found at edwired.org. Thanks for joining us, Mills, and maybe we'll talk more about that Cambodia trip after we get off the podcast.
Sounds great.
And I'm Dan Cohen, and I can be found at dancohen.org. And we'll see you again in 2 weeks on Digital Campus. Again, you can visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself. Thank you.